Welcome. I'm Maliha Razazon, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It is now 1 week since the city of Boston was essentially shut down as law enforcement vigorously searched and eventually found the remaining suspect in the Boston Marathon bombings. In the last 12 days, the story has dominated the media, and the coverage has been both exemplary and in some cases downright inaccurate. This week, the narrative has changed. The manhunt is over, but the search for information has not slowed. The coverage has turned to the captured subject, Zokhar Tsarnaev, and his legal perils. At the beginning of the week, Republican senators such as Lindsey Graham and John McCain urged the Obama administration to treat Tsarnaev as an enemy combatant, which would allow for military detention and interrogation. Despite that request, Tsarnaev was in fact charged in a civilian court, but that has not ended the debate in the media as to whether he should be labeled an enemy combatant. When an incident like this could lead to further restrictions on our rights, how could media and how should media unpack the political messages and question the official narratives? In his latest article for Mother Jones, How the FBI in Boston May Have Pursued the Wrong Terrorist, Trevor Aronson looks at the FBI's $3 billion counterterrorism program and how its strategy of running sting operations against would-be terrorists may have backfired. Trevor Aronson is co-editor of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, and he joins us on the phone from Florida. Good to have you, Trevor.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. We are also joined by Scott Horton. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues for his blog, The No Comment. Great to have you back, Scott.
Great to be with you.
And in the past week, there has been no shortage of stories and tweets about Chechnya and the possible link between the suspected bombers and Chechen extremist groups. But the lack of understanding about the history and geography was so evident that Czech embassy had to issue a statement clarifying that the two Boston bombing suspects actually traced back their roots to Chechnya, not the Czech Republic. Our today's guest, Anna Butkin, has covered Chechnya since 2001 and has written extensively about human rights violations there. Anna Butkin has written about conflicts on three continents, including Russia's war in Chechnya. Her latest book, The World is a Carpet, is about Afghanistan, and she's writing a book, and she's working on a new book called Trans Science. Hi, Anna.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are welcome, and thank you for being on the show. I think you're going to clear a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation about Chechnya's history today. But as we do always on Fridays, we start on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. And let's start with you, Scott. What did you see this week that you thought was particularly well reported?
Well, I was very impressed with the piece that Spencer Ackerman wrote for Wired about a hearing that occurred before a Senate subcommittee that produced really amazing testimony from a young Yemeni gentleman named Faraya al-Muslimi, who went to high school in California and returned to Yemen. And he gave direct evidence of the effect of the drone war the United States is waging on his homeland. And he described in great detail what had happened in his native village when it had been hit by a drone strike, and how this had radicalized the population and turned them against the United States. So I think most of what we hear about America's drone campaign consists of discussion by national security experts who talk about targeting, talk about the efficacy of strikes. We very rarely see perspectives from ground level and through the eyes of the affected local population. And this was, I think, an effective hearing and also a very, very good piece by Spencer Ackerman writing it up.
And this gets some coverage. The New York Times and Washington Post both ran stories on the hearing, but for Accuracy in Media, it said that the search of the Nexus News database ran up nothing on broadcast network cable channels or national public radio. So why do you think this did not get so much attention at a time where everybody was focused on the Boston bombings?
Everybody was focused on the Boston bombings. I think that's it. I think the coverage has focused on the FBI investigations and things falling out of it, questions about the way police handled things. And I think this particular hearing, while it actually does bear an important background relationship, was really ignored. I think overall it points to the unbalanced way the media has been covering the drone issue generally. It has been through the eyes of so-called national security and foreign policy experts in Washington, and very rarely through the eyes of anyone else.
Because, you know, it's very interesting, the Tom Brokaw, he appeared on Meet the Press last Sunday, and he connected these two issues, actually, the drone attacks to what we saw, the horrific acts in Boston, even though not all the information was out. But he made a link into when we go out and bomb other people and kill civilians, there should be no surprise that something like this would happen in the U.S. But he was just sort of talking in terms of general policy, U.S. foreign policies, not in particular. And what about you, Aaron? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I'm obviously very interested in how federal law enforcement pursues sting operations, and I'm a big fan of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which I think for being a newspaper in Milwaukee does really amazing journalism. And they had a series today that built on some of their earlier reporting that looked at how the ATF was running sting operations and then losing track of what it was doing. So they had an earlier story about how they were doing gun buying stings and losing track of the guns. And most recently, as the Milwaukee paper is reporting, they were running cigarette stings where they were selling, you know, so-called black market cigarettes and then, you know, selling them off to, you know, would-be buyers who were selling them on the black market and then totally losing track of where that was going.
So Trevor, can you say exactly where you saw this story again? So because we put in for this information on our website later.
Absolutely. It was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Okay. And kudos to them. And you, Anna, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I know we'll talk about this some more after we do this kudos part, but I enjoyed very much and recommend very highly a piece by Oliver Bullough that ran in Foreign Policy last Sunday called The Roots of Chechen Rage. If we are going to examine the Chechen angle, whether there is one or isn't one is another subject, of what happened in Boston. But if we really are going to look in depth at Chechnya, I think that this is the one piece that I would really recommend. Very coherent and compassionate, and points at the history of a very, very traumatized and beleaguered nation in the Russian Caucasus.
So let's talk about that, because you have reported from Chechnya, and the last time you went there, I believe, was in February of 2010 to report on the insurgency and the human rights violations that continue to haunt Chechnya. And
sure.
You had to hide your identity as a journalist so you could actually report on human rights situation there. So first off, why did you have to hide your identity? Why couldn't you go in?
For a number of reasons. One is I am a foreign correspondent, and in order to be a foreign correspondent, in order to operate in Chechnya, I would have had to have multiple permissions from multiple governments, both the government of Russia and the government of Chechnya and the Russian security services and the Chechen security services, and that would have taken a very, very long time to obtain if I even were granted those permissions. And then once I would have been granted those permissions, I would have been assigned a tail, which essentially would mean that I would have to be accompanied everywhere, either in the open or undercover by representatives of Russian or Chechen or both security structures. And since the reason I went to Chechnya was to report on abuses by both of these governments against Russian civilians or Chechen civilians, because Chechnya, we mustn't forget, Chechnya is a part of Russia. It's sort of like Texas is a part of the United States.
It's one of the 26 federations. Yeah, I mean,
correct.
Subject.
So when we talk about Chechnya and Chechen citizens, they're Russian citizens. So let's talk about the atrocities perpetrated by the Russian government against its own citizens. And, of course, having Russian or Chechen security services in tow wouldn't have aided me in my goal of obtaining information, and it probably would have endangered tremendously my sources on the ground. So that was the full-sided reason why I went undercover.
So I know you just came back from Mali. I mean, you've been back for a few days. So when the Chechen identity and ethnicity of the two alleged bombers, Tamer Lazarev and Zokar, became clear, we started seeing these headlines about whether there is a Chechen connection to the Boston bombing. So when you heard about that, when you read about that, what was your initial reaction?
Well, I had two reactions. One was how wonderful that after 19 years of what essentially amounts to genocide by the Russian government and by the Chechen government against the Chechens, we're finally again paying attention. And I actually began covering the conflict in Chechnya in the 90s, shortly after the first war in Chechnya began, which was 1994. So at the time, the American public wasn't as distracted with its own wars against global terror in Afghanistan and Iraq, and there was a lot of attention on what was happening in Chechnya, at least in the first couple of years. Massive atrocities and carpet bombings of civilians and executions of entire villages made front page news in the United States, and then that faded away. And at the same time as the independence movement in Chechnya was basically hijacked by hardline Islamist movement. And so the combination of the two and the beginning of America's own wars on terror, first in Afghanistan and Iraq, Chechnya disappeared from our attention to such an extent that now we don't really know whether it's the Czech Republic or Chechnya and other post-Soviet states. So one of the reactions I had was, especially looking at pieces such as Oliver Bolo's piece, which is wonderful, I thought, this is great that finally we're learning about a conflict that has killed, nobody really knows how many, but hundreds of thousands of civilians. At the same time, I thought, and I do believe, and I may be proven wrong, but I do believe that looking at focusing on the Chechnya angle of what happened in Boston is a distraction, a dangerous distraction. From what I am reading, and I'm, again, with a caveat, speaking with a caveat that I just returned from Mali and I haven't, I'm still catching up, but from what I'm reading, the Tsarnaev brothers were American, young American terrorists, or at least the people who, that's the profile that they fit.
So I think we're going. So I think we should talk about this a little more. And also, I want to bring in Trevor and Scott, and ask both of you to comment on what she was saying about Chechnya being forgotten, and this was an opportunity to learn more about its history, its really troubled and traumatic history. So Scott, I want to ask you this question. Do you think that even if we put aside the bombings in Boston. Do you think that the media, journalists, really use this opportunity to explore the past history of Chechnya and its relationship with Russia, and how it really sometimes even juxtaposes and parallels the U.S. policies in the Middle East?
Well, I think there was very, very minimal briefing in the broadcast press reports about the Chechen angle. The perpetrators were identified as being ethnically Chechen, and there were brief discussions about the history of the conflict, and there was a lot of talk about Islamist radical cells in Chechnya, but there really wasn't an effort to explain what is, you know, one of the great tragedies within Europe or within Eurasia, in any event, a war that's gone on and has been frozen now for, you know, two decades, and that has cost countless thousands of lives there. And I think even in terms of the militarization or radicalization of Chechnya, there was a focus on the Islamist radicals, but of course the situation is far more complex than that. There was an independence movement that was not initially in the control of those radicals, and the current government and the current president is itself linked to a lot of radical and violent action. In fact, to assassination teams that have carried out hits in Europe in places like Vienna and London in the past, and have been linked credibly to the deaths of some very important journalists. So I think there is a whole tragic story there that could have been presented as one of the backdrops here, and never really was. And instead, what we got were hours and hours of empty commentary from reporters on the street talking about passing fire trucks.
And that's Scott Horton. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues on his blog, The No Comment. We are also joined by Trevor Aronson, co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, and Anna Butkin. She's an independent journalist and has written about conflicts on three continents, including Russia's war in Chechnya. And we also want to hear from you. What do you think about the coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings in Boston? And what have we learned, whether it's about geopolitics of Chechnya, whether about more information, more revelation about what happened, if we can really concretely put together a story of what happened on that day last Monday? Call us at 866-798-8255. Send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave your message or your comment on our website, yourcallradio.org, 866-798-8255. So I want to go back to what you said, Anna, in terms of this, there is no Chechen connection here. These two young men never lived in Chechnya, and they grew up in Kyrgyzstan, and then they went to United States, to Boston. So when you think that this is something that its roots has to be found in the United States, can you elaborate on that a little more?
Yes. First of all, I never said that there is no Chechen connection. If you know, we know that Tamerlan Tsarnaev did go to Chechnya, so, and they both are ethnically Chechen, so there is a tenuous Chechen connection. What I was saying was that I think it is dangerous for the United States, for us as American public, from the point of view of self-preservation and self-education, to look away from the fact that these two young men were living in the United States as Americans, leading American lifestyles. And whatever trauma or radicalization or education that influenced them, that was part of their Chechen identity, of course it's important to look at that. But what I'm saying is that these were not, you know, people from another country who came here to bomb the United States. They were here to live.
Because
that's
this...
a completely different profile of terrorist profile than the, you know, the 9/11 terrorists.
So, Trevor, I want to bring you into this conversation. In your new book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, you discuss how FBI has become a proactive counterterrorism organization as opposed to a law enforcement agency reacting to real crimes. And the fact that FBI got a tip from Russia about Tamerlan visiting Dagestan and they suspected him, but eventually FBI dropped, and you have a piece about another case and what FBI counterinsurgency has really been about since 9/11. So has this community been under watch in general, the Chechen community in Boston or other places?
Well, not just the Chechen community in Boston or elsewhere, but really, you know, Muslim communities nationwide have received an incredible amount of surveillance and the intrusion of informants since 9/11. You know, today the FBI has an unprecedented number of informants. They have 15,000 registered informants. Many of them are focused on ferreting out would-be terrorists in Muslim communities. You know, they're looking for people who are espousing violence, who say they want to commit some sort of act of terrorism. And what I write about in my book is how these sting operations don't really seem to be, you know, targeting people who have the capability of committing terrorism. They're people who have an idea for terrorism and have no means at all. And the FBI, through these elaborate and aggressive sting operations, will provide everything, the transportation, the bombs, the logistics, everything that they need to commit an act of terrorism that on their own they could not. And then once they, you know, push the button to detonate the bomb that the FBI provided, they're arrested and charged with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction. And this, these cases are announced to the public as, you know, hey, look at us, this is the FBI keeping you safe. But if you look closely at the evidence, there's very little evidence to suggest that the men caught in these sting operations could have become the terrorists that they're able to through these sting operations, that they could have acquired the weapons that the FBI provided to them. And so the question I asked in my book, which came out in January, is what are we missing when we're pursuing such low-hanging fruit? Mentally troubled and mentally ill and economically desperate who are often caught in these sting operations. And I think what the Tamerlan Tsarnaev case and the Boston bombing case raise is a part of that answer, which is to say that in January 2011, we know that the FBI, on information from Russia, interviewed Tamerlan Tsarnaev and looked at his web traffic in trying to figure out if he was connected to any kind of terrorist group or was sympathetic to terrorism. And they said they couldn't find anything. And they, you know, according to the FBI and what we know so far, they didn't track him any further. At the same time, they spent considerable resources going after a man named Rezwan Firdaus, who came to their attention through an FBI informant who was a heroin addict and was being paid thousands of dollars. And Firdaus had this ridiculous plan of flying a remote-controlled airplane into the Capitol loaded with explosives and then detonating it on the Gold Dome. Of course, he didn't have the ability to do that, and the FBI gave him $4,000 to purchase a plane, gave him all the C4 he needed, gave him money to travel to Washington to scout out locations, and then when they provided him with the explosives, they arrest him and charge him with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction and say to the Boston public, you know, here's the FBI keeping you safe. Look at this terrorist that we found. But the evidence in this case clearly showed that were it not for the FBI, he never could have committed his crime.
Yeah. Trevor, hold that thought. We are coming up against the break. So I'm just going to take this to say this is your call. I am Maliha Razazan sitting for Rose Aguilar. And this is our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we talk with journalists about the coverage of week's news. And that was the voice of Trevor Aronson, co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and author of The Terror Factory Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. We'll be back after this break.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in the Your Call weekly email newsletter, which is easy to sign up for and free. You just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. Join the conversation this morning, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or send an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org. Coming up, Sunday, May the 5th, at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House, David Sedaris with an evening of all new recordings and recollections, celebrating his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. David Sedaris, Sunday, May 5th, San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House. Ticket information at davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you joining us now, I am Malihera Zazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to our past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we've had about youth mentorship programs. Mentors can offer anything from academic encouragement to help dealing with life's challenges, and these relationships have the powerful ability to help people cross social boundaries. If you have been a mentor or a mentee, how did it change you, and what mentoring program would you recommend? This is a rebroadcast with Rose Aguilar. And today is our media roundtable discussion. Today we talk with reporters and journalists about coverage of week's news. According to Pew Research, the Boston bombing were the most closely watched news story since the 2008 financial crisis, and it generated as much attention as the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But a week or so later, how are we looking back, and how are we piecing all this information together, and how are the media really helping us to understand this better, what we can learn about United States, our civil liberties, about U.S. foreign policy? So what sort of lessons we can learn once again from this horrific and tragic story? Joining us today is Trevor Aronson. He is the co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and the author of Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And we are also joined by Scott Horton. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues for the blog The No Comment. And we have lost Anna, if I'm not mistaken. But Scott and Trevor, we have a question from a listener, Zia, who wants to know about geography and connection with Dagestan, Chechnya, and Russia. Good morning, Zia.
Good morning, Malie. I'm calling from Santa Fe, California. Like most American public, I am rather confused. I would like to know the relationship between Dagestan, Chechnya, Ossetia, Georgia, their relationship with the Russian Federation, their relationship with their neighbors like Iran, like Turkey.
So, Zia, I think we need to do a show about this. This is going to take more than a minute. But Scott, do you want to try this?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe an easy way to back into it is to look at literature. I mean, if you've ever read the short stories of Count Tolstoy, he's talking about all these battles going on in the North Caucasus, the story of Shamil, for instance. And this is an area that Russia moved into around 1800 for the first time, beginning to occupy it. And there were wars that went on for several generations at this time, back and forth between the Russian army and the locals, fighting to maintain their independence, fighting quite fiercely sometimes. Of all the peoples in the North Caucasus, the Chechens are the ones who had the greatest renown for military valor and for fighting for their independence, yet they wound up being held by Russia even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, whereas the countries to the south, like Georgia, became autonomous and independent, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. And I think this spirit of independence and demand to be free of the Russian yoke is what drove the civil war in Chechnya. And Dagestan is a far less populated nation just immediately to the east of Chechnya. But Chechnya has been a center of resistance to Russian power and rule for more than 200 years.
So, Zia, I hope that answers your question. And that is Scott Horton, the contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. So, Scott and Trevor, let's dive in and talk about domestically what has transpired since last week. One thing that there were two major issues that came out after the arrest of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. One was the fact that he was not read his Miranda rights, and the other thing was how to really label him. Was he an enemy combatant or not? So I wanted to take your you have written about this in 2010. I remember you wrote a piece about Miranda rights and how Justice Department was really pushing to sort of suspend it or change it when it came to public safety exceptions. So what do you think about this, the coverage of this, and how we have been discussing Miranda rights in case of this suspect specifically? Scott?
I think, you know, this is a test. This is a very, very important test case for this public safety exception. And I think the way they reacted and the way they used it is, you know, it's consistent with the way the Holder Justice Department rewrote the public safety exception, giving them more flexibility. They took a day before they Mirandized him, and he was interrogated at length about further public risk. A number of critics have come in and said, well, you had the city on lockdown, and you told people they can go about their work, so you obviously didn't really think that there was a public safety risk at the time you held him and did this. But I think under all the circumstances, they needed to exclude the possibility that there were others working with him who presented an imminent threat, and I think they did that. So I think the way it was conducted was broadly within the public safety exception as that's been traditionally understood and as it's been reinterpreted. The enemy combatant issue is really entirely different, and I think this is a struggle over the legitimacy of the Guantanamo military commissions, and it's particularly two people. It's John McCain and Lindsey Graham who want to build this into a part of the American criminal justice system, effectively sort of a special court that'll handle a special category of cases. That's a position that's been generally but not entirely opposed by the Obama administration. And this case would have been a ridiculous example, in my view. And they're also pushing it at a time when the Guantanamo military commissions themselves are nearing a complete meltdown over disclosures that attorneys have been taped in their conversations with their clients, and in fact that some people from the CIA were sitting with their finger on the button outside of the courtroom determining what could be heard and what couldn't be heard by audiences. All pretty outrageous stuff, which is really discrediting the military commissions in the eyes of the entire world.
So do you think his case is going to have a significance for Guantanamo prisoners?
I think there's a serious question right now whether the military commissions, as they've been reconstituted, will be able to go forward. I think these proceedings are coming close to collapse, and I think his case is going to go through the normal federal criminal justice system, which has its problems, but the problems are not nearly so severe as those of the military commissions. And I think, if we look at the way terrorism cases have been tried in the regular federal court system, you see that the federal prosecutors carry them through to completion in very good time, and they have an over 90% conviction rate. They're actually do much better, and they get longer sentences than we get out of the military commission. So from the perspective of a prosecutor trying to pick his forum, in which forum would he rather bring the case, I doubt any prosecutor would pick the military commissions over a federal court to start with. This is just it's a ridiculous political issue that evaporates when people really drill down to the facts.
It's very interesting you're saying this, because I was thinking maybe one of the reasons Obama administration has decided to try him in the civilian court is because they have been wanting to shut down Guantanamo. They have not been able to do so, and these prisoners are in a legal limbo. So in one way, they are trying to create this sort of a parallel legal system, which is a civil courts, instead of throwing people back into Guantanamo and have them stay there for indefinite times. Would that could that be a thinking for the administration?
I think that's exactly right. In fact, they haven't sent any new people to Guantanamo, even though they've had several far more plausible options than this one. You know, one of the pirates off the coast of Somalia, for instance. I think it's clear that the administration wants to shut down Guantanamo, but it's not willing to expend a lot of energy or political capital to achieve that, and Congress has thrown up a lot of roadblocks. So we have this sort of standoff situation with Guantanamo, but you know, the administration is determined not to see the Guantanamo problem expand.
So, Trevor, I want to get your take on this. So what do you think about this debate for looking for terrorists and classifying them as enemy combatants or not reading them their Miranda rights? What do you think about what is happening with specifically with this case?
Yeah, I mean, I agree very much with what Scott said. I mean, it was clear early on once Johar was detained that the threat was over, that there wasn't any that there weren't any connections. There wasn't a bomb about to go off in another city that he was connected to. So the exemption to Miranda rights was certainly questionable there. And also, as Scott pointed out, you know, the Department of Justice has a stellar record of prosecuting alleged terrorists in federal courts. You know, the percentage of guilty pleas is enormous. I think it's right around 85% of people charged with terrorism offenses. And if you compare his case, for example, to, you know, Faiz Shahzad, who delivered the bomb to Times Square that fortunately did not go off, you know, like Shahzad, Johar doesn't have any greater connections to someone who's plotting terrorist acts in the United States, and so they prosecuted him in civilian court, and ultimately he pleaded guilty to the charges and was sentenced to federal prison. And I don't see the advantages here of, you know, trying to label him an enemy combatant. And I'm actually somewhat surprised that McCain and Graham's, you know, shouts for this got as much attention as they did, and that there really wasn't a pushback in saying, you know, maybe Scott can correct me. I mean, I don't think there would even be the legal authority to declassify him as an enemy combatant since his crime was wholly within the United States.
And the other thing is that it's not really exactly clear whether he had any connections, what they knew, what they didn't know. I mean, everything, I mean, disinformation is being collected as we speak.
Right. And, you know, what he's saying so far seems to suggest that there wasn't any connections to overseas groups. And so for that reason, I mean, he's really not that much different a terrorist than, you know, someone who picks up arms and shoots up a movie theater. But, you know, because of, you know, his being Muslim, his kind of distant connections, his brother's distant connections to Russia, you know, this was treated far more as a terrorist case than, you know, some other criminal acts that are just as terrorizing and just as deadly.
And we have an email. I just want to read this, an anonymous caller. It says, what do you have to say about the idea that not fascism, but the instruments of fascism have been steadily in place in this country since 9/11, as in the ghost town shutdown of an entire metropolitan area to catch a 19-year-old kid, and that the Boston region lockdown was essentially a martial law drill in which the government first gets the people to welcome such instrument as fascism always historically work. Well, Scott, you necessarily don't agree with this assessment.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's absolutely appropriate to focus on the lockdown as something that's historically unprecedented, and in retrospect looks a little silly because, I mean, we now know that the last of the two to be captured was lying in a boat, unarmed and bleeding, as the entire metropolitan area was put on lockdown and hundreds of rounds of ammunition were being fired. And so it looks in retrospect like a ridiculous overreaction. But I think we have to back up and say, of course, that's with hindsight. And at the time, the threat looked very serious, and the authorities were within their rights in dealing with this as a very severe threat. But they have the legal power to do it. It's not just fascism. It's all modern democracies give the police forces this sort of authority when they're dealing with health emergencies, for instance, or terrorist incidents. But I think in using those powers, they have a very important balance to strike, and that is between protecting the public and actually instilling more of a sense of panic or fear. I mean, if they do the latter, then they're allowing the terrorists effort to be successful, because, of course, that's the whole objective here, is to breed hysteria, panic, and fear. And I think here they went a little bit over the line in the way they handled it. I think it doesn't look like a great example in retrospect.
And I want to pose this question to you as well, Trevor, but I just want to mention that Jane Mayer of New Yorker, she said something very interesting. She said that as the result of the bombing and the information that was coming out, is that now we can actually understand that we do live in a surveillance state in some ways, because there were so many photos, thousands and thousands of photos that was accessible to the FBI and federal government. And at the same time, we found out that there were 700,000 people who are quote-unquote pinged. It means that their every move on the internet is followed. And they are being... And that takes me to what you have written about the use of informants in FBI for actually going after and finding out these suspects. So can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I read a piece in The Guardian, and an intelligence officer, Trevor, says, "Do we spy on Musk? You need to tell me there is someone who is considering an act of violence first. It is inappropriate to intervene in a religious activity without you telling me that someone is there, is doing something wrong." So do you think that because of these constitutional restrictions that federal government has, they are basically going to these informants to do their job for them?
Well, you know, the FBI's response and justification for this is to say that, you know, we would not pursue anyone in a mosque or anywhere else unless we had a predicate, a reason to believe that they were committing some sort of crime or involved in some sort of crime. And they stand by this. That's the FBI's public statements. But if you look at the cases that have gone through court, you know, there's testimony from FBI agents and informants who describe, you know, going into Muslim communities for months. You know, a case in outside New York City, for example, an informant spent 10 months in a Muslim community in Newburgh, was at one mosque so often that they invited him to join the board of directors. And only after, you know, trolling that mosque for 10 months did he finally run into someone who, you know, was mentally ill and economically desperate and got involved in a terrorist plot with him. And, you know, I think, you know, when you talk to Muslims in the United States, a joke you often hear is, oh, when I pray on Friday, I just assume that the person next to me is an informant. I mean, obviously that's an exaggeration, but it gives you a sense of how much this community feels under siege by law enforcement. And, you know, now since the Boston bombings, we are getting, you know, more and more calls for greater and greater surveillance of U.S. Muslim communities. And I think the real question is, you know, even with greater surveillance, can they really prevent the next attack? I mean, I think what the Boston case shows is that even with aggressive sting operations that seem to net highly questionable subjects, you know, people of questionable importance and questionable danger, they're not able to stop the people who really can launch an attack, such as Faisal Shahzad or the Tsarnaev brothers in Boston. So I have real doubts that even if they increase surveillance, which raises additional questions about civil liberties, whether that'll keep us any safer than before.
And related to this issue that you just brought up about Muslims being targeted, we have a caller, Eat from Berkeley. Good morning, Eat.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, this whole very unfortunate thing, terrible as it is, killing a lot of innocent people and maiming them, is totally counterproductive, not only for those people of those idiots, people of Chechnya, which is totally damaged by Russia. And Russia is going to use this incident to destroy more people of Chechnya, but overall, the millions or the billions of Muslims around the world. And, you know, the sad thing, they are used by people like Peter King from New York, Fox News, the whole new conservative movement, and, you know, the whole crazy people like Gaffney and Pipe and Bernard Lewis, who created the falsehood of class, of civilization. And really, as everybody knows, the war against terror is bogus. It is war against the American people to scare them to death so that they give civil liberties, their social security, their money, their jobs, their everything. And this kind of idiots, killers. I felt very sad when I saw these dancers last night on TV without her foot, where her foot is gone. What is wrong with you guys? What good did you do for the Muslim people? What good did you do for Palestine? What good did you do for Iraq or Afghanistan? You're just getting the worst people in the world, the new conservatives, to use the biggest army in the world, the American army, to destroy your own people. Stop this nonsense. You don't kill innocent people. It is the war in terror is bogus. I'll attribute that. It is actually creation. And somehow, like, this new conservative people are really clever. They are
Thank you so much, Eid. So, Scott, you know, continuing on what Eid said, why do you think that every time such a horrific event happens, we always fail to try to understand, really, how can we place these events in the larger U.S. foreign policy framework? Because in the beginning you talked about drones, and we hardly hear about the relationship between the civilians being killed there and there might be a blowback here in this country. And Glenn Greenwald had a piece in The Guardian a couple of days ago, and he said every single person who has been arrested and who has been a suspect, they all basically say Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, drones. So why do you think we still fail to make these connections, not to justify the acts, but to try to understand it? Scott, I want to start with you.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of political pushback in this country to even having a discussion of these matters. And if an effort is made to understand these things for purposes of understanding causation, we see a pushback that, you're justifying what a terrorist has done, or you're seeing what he's doing as reasonable. So I think that's a problem with a lot of the media discourse on these issues in the United States. But I think from the perspective of those who really want to understand terrorism as a problem, you have to understand what motivates a terrorist, what leads to these decisions. And I think there, understanding how terrorists are recruited and what motivates them requires us to understand what the U.S. has done in the Middle East, U.S. engagement in Iraq and in Afghanistan, for instance, and in other areas. I mean, it's clear you drop a lot of bombs on a lot of people and you're going to make a lot of enemies. And drone war in Pakistan and Yemen likewise have these consequences. But I'd also say it doesn't stop there. Because if we're studying terrorism as a problem in the United States, it's far from clear that the principal problem with terrorism in the U.S. domestically is Islamist terrorists. I mean, if we count the number of incidents, there are more incidents involving the radical right and other hate groups in the United States than there are Islamists. And I think, frankly, we need to be targeting all these groups and understanding what motivates and what moves them. That's how you undertake appropriate steps to deal with them, to stop it at the source.
And also the language that that we use, I mean, in terms of who is considered to be a terrorist and what does exactly radicalization means. And I want to throw this question at you, Trevor. For example, there are 700,000 people on FBI's watch list. And as you said, that we live in an environment that we are surveilled 24/7. So why do you think that, for example, this story that you wrote about how FBI is spending so much money on informants and going after the wrong people, these sort of stories, why don't they get more attention? Your story was picked up, a couple of days later after you wrote it by Washington Post. It was cited in a blog. But this is really a very, very important issue, and it gets to the heart of, you know, American democracy and freedom of speech and the right of association. So why do you think that we are in some ways failing to shed light on these issues in the media?
You know, that's a good question, and I wish the media would more aggressively pursue this. I think, you know, I've been writing about this subject for a few years now, and in that time I have seen a slow shift in the media being more skeptical of terrorism sting operations, more skeptical of defendants who are portrayed as dangerous terrorists by the U.S. government, but on closer look end up being kind of idiot jihadis who, you know, don't have any means for any terrorist attack on their own. And I think this is something that the media needs to look take a greater look at. I mean, I think what Scott brought up is really important to understand and realize, which is that I think when Americans think of terrorism, they see a Muslim face. But if you look at the data, you know, that you're far more likely to be harmed by a right-wing terrorist in the United States than you are by, you know, an Islamic terrorist. You're far more likely to be killed by a lone gunman than you are by an Islamic terrorist. You know, this isn't an enormous threat within the United States, but because we view sting operations in such an aggressive way in Muslim communities, and in a way that we haven't in other communities, it's really exaggerated the threat of Muslim homegrown terrorism within the United States. It does exist, as Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his brother showed us, but it doesn't exist on the levels that we've seen. It doesn't exist in the hundreds of cases that the U.S. government has prosecuted through sting operations. And I think the real question, the greater question that I hope is asked, and why I'm really grateful that the Washington Post wrote an editorial about this and mentioned my reporting, is whether we should be questioning whether, as a result of these sting operations, the FBI is really missing the true threats, the people who really pose dangers, while they're, you know, concocting elaborate stings on low-hanging fruit, the mentally ill and the economically desperate.
Hmm. And Scott, since you cover civil rights and national security issues, where do you think the media should take its focus? And what do we need to understand about the political and constitutional implications of the arrest and you know, the prosecution of the suspect right now?
Well, I become concerned about the sort of saturation coverage we get in events like this, in which we see mass speculation. We saw the New York Post identify, you know, some innocent young men as the perpetrators on their front page and refuse to walk it back. We saw a lot of similar sensationalizing. That's a huge problem for us. And I think that what that builds into is a drive, particularly by what I call the national security right within the Republican Party, for retrenchment of civil liberties. And I think we've got to stand firmly against that. This idea of military justice supplanting domestic justice is unwise and inefficient, and it really undermines the Constitution.
And we're going to be following this story. We have to leave it here. We've been speaking with Harper Scott Horton, Florida Center for Investigative Reporting's Trevor Aronson, and independent journalist Anna Butkin. You can read all their stories at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for your calls. Thank you for emails. Sorry we could not get to all of them. What is the value of youth mentoring programs? On the next call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had about youth mentorship programs. Mentors can offer anything from academic encouragement to help dealing with life's challenges. And these relationships have the powerful ability to help people cross social boundaries. If you have been a mentor or a mentee, how did it change you? What mentoring programs would you recommend to others? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.